Major support for Louisiana Eats on WWNO provided by Zatarain's, proud producers of authentic New Orleans-style cuisine. Zatarain's, a New Orleans tradition since 1889.
From WWNO New Orleans, this is Louisiana Eats. I'm Poppy Tooker. On this week's show, master distiller Tom Nickel explains the complexities of one of the world's most famous liquors, originally created by Charles Tanqueray in 1830. Then, we travel to Baton Rouge to learn about the Red Stick Farmers Market's new mobile market effort, bringing fresh local food to notorious food deserts. And we'll wind up the fun with a rollicking cocktail tour conducted by Richard Reed, Elizabeth Pierce, and thank you.
Major support for Louisiana Eats provided by Zatarain's, proud producers of authentic New Orleans-style cuisine. Zatarain's, a New Orleans tradition since 1889.
From WWNO New Orleans, this is Louisiana Eats. I'm Poppy Tooker. On this week's show, master distiller Tom Nickel explains the complexities of one of the world's most famous liquors, originally created by Charles Tanqueray in 1830. Then, we travel to Baton Rouge to learn about the Red Stick Farmers Market's new mobile market effort, bringing fresh local food to notorious food deserts. And we'll wind up the fun with a rollicking cocktail tour conducted by Richard Reed, Elizabeth Pierce, and Allison Olson, authors of the new French Quarter Drinking Companion. We're drinking around the world and eating local, too, on this week's Louisiana Eats.
Long before specialty craft gins became the rage, there already was a specialty gin. A gin recognized the world over by its distinctive green bottle and very special flavor. That gin is Tanqueray. The master distiller who carefully tends that gin today is Tom Nickel. Tom, welcome to Louisiana Eats.
Thank you. Nice to be here.
What makes gin so unique?
I think gin itself, it has lots of flavors in it that can actually be mixed for mixologists, that they can add their own flavors to it and enhance what's in the gin in the first place. I would say for other drinks, sometimes whiskey for me is best drink on its own. And vodka is vodka. You throw other stuff into it. Lots of people like vodka rather than gin, but I'm afraid I don't. I prefer gin.
So, your distilling career began in Scotland, I know. So I imagine that your first distilling efforts must have involved Scotch whiskey.
Yes. I lived roughly about half a mile away from a distillery where my father, he worked there for 27 years before I started there.
So he was a distiller also?
Yeah, he worked in the distilling industry most of his life after the war.
Wow.
Because he met my mother after the war, moved up from England. He's an Englishman, so I'm half English. I'm quite proud of that. So he started work in the distillery. And it was only when I was 17, I was basically called to the distillery for an interview and told you start on Monday.
Oh, that's so exciting. So you've been doing this since you were 17 years old.
Yes.
So I imagine you're a pretty rare animal in a lot of ways. Are there a whole bunch of you out there with that many years of incredible experience behind you?
You'd be surprised at how many years people have that have worked for the same company. It's changed its name about 3 or 4 times, but it's still the same company.
And so you made the move from Scotch to what you believe is the most complex spirit to distill, gin.
When the gin distillery moved up to Cameron Bridge, I was actually busy at the time trying to conquer neutral spirit. So I declined and taken part in a job there. But a few years later, the master distiller, he moved away into whiskey.
Oh!
He'd actually came up from Landen in Essex. He was an Essex boy. I'd been nosing gin and neutral spirit and whiskey in the lab since it started.
Uh-huh.
It was always in my mind then, oh, I've got to get into gin because it just smells so great compared to whiskey or neutral spirit.
It's like a bouquet of flowers in a lot of ways, isn't it?
Yes, it's a really nice job to have.
When you nose the gin, what is it that you're smelling for?
Well, really, when I nose the gin, it's through the distillation. So the distillation starts off sort of high in strength, but low in flavour.
Uh-huh.
So as the distillation goes through, it's roughly about a 6-hour distillation. The strength starts to come down, but the flavour goes up. So I'm looking for juniper kicking at the right time, coriander coming in at the right time. So I'm actually nosing the gin all the way through the distillation. And in my head, I can't explain what I'm looking for because other people will look for other things.
Yes.
But for me, it's got to be the same all the time. And as soon as I walk into the still house, I know if things are right. I can smell it right away. I've always found that the best nosers are women. We have some young girls in the lab that they come in and they just get it right away. But we don't let them on a panel yet. We do it again. If they get it right again, and well, it's okay, that's two times, then fine. But we make them do it again if they're 100% a third time.
Yeah, there you go. Well, you know, I was completely surprised to discover that what I think everybody knows as Tanqueray London Dry Gin isn't made in London or even England.
The only gin that's really an English gin as such is Plymouth Gin. But that's geographically, that's the only one that's there. Any other gin can be called a London Dry, even if it's made in America.
Because that's a technique?
It's the same. It's a style of gin rather than where it's made.
Ah. I was really fascinated that you have had the opportunity to read the recipe journal of the brand's founder, Charles Tanqueray. When do those journals date back to?
Right back from 1830. He was 20 years old at the time. There was some good gins about at the time, but not great. So
uh-huh.
He seized the opportunity to get into gin. He just managed to get the recipe spot on, and it's not easy to do, I can assure you. He died when he was 58, which was unfortunate. So he was born in 1810, so it was 1868 that he actually died. But his son took over from him. And you can actually see the change in writing in the books from his father's writing to his son's writing. But it was great. The recipes in there are unbelievable. He came up with a new recipe every 3 weeks.
Every 3 weeks?
Yes, but it wasn't just gin. He loved horses, and he would foot rot in horses. He'd come up with something like that. Or for shining their coats. And you know, everything.
So Charles Tanqueray was really the gin genius.
Yes, for me anyway, definitely.
What are your thoughts? You know, there is such an incredible craft spirit movement going on. What are your thoughts on these new craft gins that we're seeing emerge?
I think it's fine because it keeps gin in the sort of booming category. I'd be very surprised if many of these gins tasted that great, but good on these people. But I don't think most of them would make a living out of it. Because what they'll do is they'll sell a bottle for quite expensive.
Yes.
And then it'll sit on the back of the bar for a long, long time.
So another one of the Tanqueray's that you developed was Tanqueray 10. What is that?
Tanqueray number 10 is it's a more citrus-flavoured gin. And this was one of the new age gins that came out. And the reason for that was to get into sort of a market for martini market. It's perfect in a martini. It's the same four botanicals used in London Dry, which is juniper, coriander, angelica and licorice, but with the added fresh fruit. Now, it's not easy to distill fresh fruit, but I do oranges, limes and grapefruits in a small still, a very small still, and I'll make a distillate, which actually goes into the large still along with the other ingredients plus chamomile flowers. And when I distill it, roughly about the first hour of distillation, everything just bounces out. It's the chamomile comes shouting at you. It's really, really nice. It's one of the best experiences you could have.
So how do you like your martinis?
For me, as little as vermouth as possible, just to sort of wipe the glass with it. Personally, I like a lemon twist. Of all the fantastic bartenders I know, there's only a few that make it exactly how I like it.
And who are they, and where is that martini?
There's in the Dorchester in London. It's a really nice hotel. And the bar manager there is a Giuliano Morandin. And he gave me a martini one day, and he just looked at my face, and he took it away immediately before I got the chance to take a second sip. And he says, "I know you don't like it." And then he made another one, gave it to me, and I thought, "Oh, that's perfect." I never ever tell a bartender how to make me a martini. That's their job. I mean, they're great at it.
Well, and it's, what about the classic question, shaken or stirred?
I like to let the bartenders do what they want to do.
Oh my goodness, you are such a liberal thinker. Well, it has been a really big kick in a very nice way to have this opportunity to talk with you. So thank you so much for coming to visit with us.
Thank you so much, Poppy.
Tanqueray Master Distiller, Tom Nickel. Louisiana Eats roving reporter Jill Benson always knows where to stop for the next delicious meal. Jill, where's our next stop?
We're going to the Dinner Bell in Macomb, Mississippi, Poppy. You hear the tolling of the dinner bell from miles away, and it's been ringing since 1945.
My gosh.
Kind of easy to just drive by, but you'll know you're on top of it because there's always a line out the door. The dinner bells open Tuesday through Sunday from 11 a.m. to 2 p.m. There are three large dining rooms, and each room is occupied by a gigantic round table. Each round table is covered by a large Lazy Susan. So service here is boarding house style.
Like family style.
It's family style. Except typically you don't sit at your dinner table and spin a thing around.
No.
You just wish you could.
So what's on the spinning table?
What's on the spinning Lazy Susan? Okay. Well, I was talking to one of the cooks at the dinner bell, and she assures me that she starts work every day at 3 a.m., and I believe this, seeing what's coming out of that kitchen. As the Lazy Susan rolls by, you take what you want from the table, and when a bowl just starts to look a little empty, out comes another lady from the kitchen to replace it. The house specialty is fried eggplant, which is fried perfectly crisp and graceless, and it's delicious. But there are so many things to choose from. There's rich, silky chicken and dumplings, spinach casserole with cream cheese and artichoke hearts. There are sweet potato casseroles, fried chicken, more chicken and dumplings, stuffed peppers, towering cakes, flaky pies. It's
wow.
It's crazy.
So what is it? A pay one price, all you can eat?
Well, Tuesday through Thursday, $12. Friday and Saturday, $14. Sunday dinner, $15.
Oh my gosh.
But children under 10, half price.
Well, it sounds really delicious, and it also sounds like a slice of something from the past that's truly almost disappeared.
Absolutely, Poppy. I've never seen anything like the dinner bell.
Well, I think I hear that bell ringing, so let's go.
Let's go, Poppy.
Louisiana Eats roving reporter Jill Benson. Back from a short break with a creative new way that the Red Stick Market has gone mobile to end food deserts in Baton Rouge. Stay tuned.
Hi, this is Bamba Fall from the Emergent Program. I listen to KRVS because it is a great opportunity to solidify communities. My favorite programs on KRVS are Franco Mix, Avec Val, and All Things Considered because they keep me company. I support KRVS because we have to act locally and think globally. KRVS is my favorite radio station because it's listener-supported. Please join me in supporting KRVS during their annual spring fundraiser.
Tune in every Saturday night at midnight for the Diamond Sea, a weekly mixtape featuring the best in independent music from the 80s, 90s, and today. Here on 88.7 KRVS, public radio for Acadiana.
KRVS, 88.7 FM, Lafayette, Lake Charles.
I'm Poppy Tooker, and you're listening to Louisiana Eats, edible content for Louisiana food lovers. Louisiana Eats is brought to you with major support from Popeye's Louisiana Kitchen and Zatarain's. Today we came out to visit the Red Stick Farmers Market latest project, mobile markets that are taking place all over the Baton Rouge area. And joining us to discuss this new project is the executive director of Breda, who is the nonprofit operating the Red Stick Farmers Market, Copper Alvarez. So, Copper, welcome to Louisiana Eats.
We're excited to be here, Poppy, and happy to be with you.
We're going to talk about the Red Stick Mobile Farmers Market effort. Tell me how it was conceived and what it has taken to get this effort going.
It's always been one of our dreams since we got started 17 years ago to actually be in a lot of different neighborhoods, no matter what the income level, go all over Baton Rouge with farmers markets. So it was starting to click with us that this might be a good way to have a chance to do one of our values and as well as work with the community. So we were also approached by a group applying for the Blue Cross Blue Shield Challenge for Louisiana Foundation's grant. They were looking at doing a project in North Baton Rouge where there were food deserts, which would be defined by USDA as neighborhoods without a grocery store within a certain mile radius. And we just got really excited because we thought this is something we'd like to do. We can actually provide food access at the same time we can actually build the number of farmers in our area working with farmers markets.
That's fantastic. And you've got this absolutely gorgeous facility, this trailer. It's big and it's so beautifully decorated. How much did that cost?
It's a 20-foot trailer, and we also purchased a pickup truck to go with it to pull it. So the combination of the two are probably about $45,000.
Wow.
We looked at what we were trying to do and decided that actually we wanted to look like a farmer's market when we showed up. So by pulling the trailer, we can either provide produce from some of our regular farmers and set up along with that trailer some new farmers and have several tents in a row. So it gives people in these neighborhoods a chance to think, oh, this is what a farmer's market is like. And it was also a little bit cheaper version. You can also unhook the truck from the trailer. You can, you know, take the truck out on farm visits. So it really served our needs much better and was more economical.
When did the mobile markets in Baton Rouge first begin?
Well, we were pretty new, and May 15th was our kickoff right here at Star Hill Church in mid-city area of Baton Rouge. So we kicked off with two sites May through July, and those were Scotlandville Library in north part of Baton Rouge up in the Scotlandville around Southern University, and then this Star Hill Church stop. We're out on the road on Wednesday at the two stops and Thursday at two new stops.
That is fantastic. Who are your customers here?
Our customers come from the neighborhood, basically, that we are setting up in. We actually have done zip code dot surveys, and we will find that people driving by, no matter where they happen to be living, will also stop. So we get a wide variety of people stopping by. And at this particular stop, in just a few minutes, Reverend Jetson's going to finish up his Bible study, and we have about 75 customers that come out. They come out from their Bible study, and they're ready to think about local produce and getting to know their farmers that they've been working with over the last few months.
And since it is a lunchtime market, because this market starts at 12:30 and Bible study starts at noon, ends at 1 o'clock, I guess everybody comes rolling out of the church thinking about what they want to cook for dinner.
Right, right. And we have plenty of things for them to purchase. When we first started, we had Swiss chard and kale. And a lot of the people in North Baton Rouge had never tried either of those. Well, before long, we had such demand for kale that, and the kale season was running out. So it was really like, oh my goodness, we taught them about how wonderful something can be, and yet, you know, now we're running out. But that's when the whole idea of seasonal is. So we have sort of realized that people are now looking forward to and can't wait for the next season to start so that they can eat what is seasonal.
And now at this table, you've got stuff growing.
So this is the mobile farmers market setup. Our staff will bring things that are not offered by the other farmers. So today you'll see that we picked up some of our Green Hand Nurseries plants to put out, and people can start their garden with the parsley or some of the chives that are here, or they can purchase possibly jalapenos and other farm ingredients that other farmers did not offer. So gives everybody a chance. Some of our farmers who've been with us forever can actually, that's where we get our produce. So all the produce at the mobile farmers market is actually a Red Stick farmer growing the produce.
Copper, would you take us inside the mobile market and show us what's in there?
Well, I might let Lisa Gray, who's our market mobile market manager, she has a much better idea of what's in there and why they have it going the way they do.
Lisa, would you welcome us onto your trailer and show us around?
Come on. This is the mobile unit that we bring around to the neighborhoods when we set up our mobile farmers market. As you can see, we have plenty of shelving and bins for storage. A lot of times we just use it for storage of our, you know, containers that we may use at the market. But most times we'll pull those things down and put our produce in there, especially in the summer months. That's why it's air conditioned to keep everything cool.
So tell me, were you part of the Red Stick Market organization before the mobile markets got started?
I sure wasn't.
You weren't. So you came on specifically for this project.
Yes, I did. I did. Actually, the mobile market targeted an area which I was familiar with that I grew up in. And I said, well, I think I should be a part of that to bring fresh local produce to the neighborhoods where I actually grew up. So I contacted Copper, and from there, here I am.
Well, it must be really rewarding because I guess you see a lot of friends and family and neighbors when you're working.
And when I'm not at work, they're still calling, where are y'all going to be tomorrow? And, you know, what are y'all going to have? Different things like that. So, yeah, it's really exciting.
That's great. Thank you so much. Copper, if you're an urban gardener, farmer, how can you get involved here with your mobile market effort?
Well, we have, for our Red Stick farmers, we actually have an application process. We visit farms, and then we take it to our advisory group. On the level of the mobile farmers market, we're looking for urban gardeners who might want to stay in agriculture or new farmers who are just starting out so that they can get a chance to grow their business. And then with this, we're actually out there beating the path, recruiting who wants to come to try to find out who are those new farmers out there.
And how do they get in touch with you, Copper?
They can get in touch with us by going to our website, which is bretta.org, and clicking on the Red Stick Farmers Market logo, or they can call us at in Baton Rouge at 225-267-5060.
And that's bretta.org. Right. Thank you, Copper.
Thank you so much for having us here today.
Thank you. One of the famous drinks created in New Orleans is the Ramos Gin Fizz. That sweet orange-scented drink is light as air and a perfect eye-opener after a wild night or to get a brunch started just right.
Henry Ramos made the first gin fizz in 1888 at his popular bar, the Imperial Cabinet Saloon, where it became such a sensation that it said he often had to employ as many as 20 shaker boys to whip up fizzes for thirsty crowds. When Louisiana's kingfish, Huey Long, was in New Orleans, he made the Roosevelt Hotel his home. He preferred his gin fizz from the Sazerac Bar there. In fact, it said he had Airline Highway constructed to cut 40 miles off of the trip from the governor's mansion in Baton Rouge to the Roosevelt, where he knew that lovely gin fizz was waiting for him. A relentless self-promoter, Huey knew how to create a stir with the press. In 1935, Huey was in New York when he discovered the hotel he was staying in claimed to be the home of the Ramos gin fizz. Huey called the Sazerac Bar and ordered head bartender Sam Guarino to fly up to New York to teach those Yankees how a real gin fizz was made. Sam complied with the governor's request. He spent 3 hours demonstrating the proper preparation of the foamy libation. It's said that a gin fizz must be shaken for 12 minutes before it's ready. But if that sounds like too much work, there's always the blender. Here's the classic recipe. In a cocktail shaker, combine 1.5 ounces of gin with 1 tablespoon of simple syrup, 1/2 ounce fresh lemon and lime juices, an egg white, 1 ounce of heavy cream, and 3 drops of orange flower water. Now, be cautious with that orange flower water. Its intensely scented flavor can overwhelm the delicate drink with just 1 too many drops. Shake together vigorously and then add ice. Shake the fizz again for another few minutes, strain into a glass, and top with just 1 ounce of soda water. Be careful. This seductive drink goes down so easily, you might find 1 is just not enough. I'm Poppy Tooker, and just like Huey Long, my perfect Louisiana brunch begins with a Ramos gin fizz. Travelers and locals alike, picking a place to grab a drink in the French Quarter with its wealth of watering holes can be daunting.
For me as a traveler, and I'll admit it, a drinker, when I come to a city that I'm not familiar with, I want to know a little bit more. I want the insider's take on what these bars, what these restaurants and clubs are like. So I think one of the most telling ways to do that is to figure out who it is that you're drinking with. You know, just apart from the bartender and what their specials are and all the decor and all that, the clientele tells you whether you're going to be comfortable there.
That was Richard Reed, who along with Allison Alsop and Elizabeth Pierce set out to do just that with their book, The French Quarter Drinking Companion. We're here to ask them about their insights into the abundance of bars in the Vieux Carré.
Well, first, we made a list of every establishment that we could identify as a place where you could get a drink. And that number was enormous. So we began to eliminate. We eliminated strip clubs because you don't go there to drink. And then we looked at, there are lots of restaurants where you can drink. So we tried to only feature restaurants that had some element that was notable about drinking there. An example would be the Bourbon House because it has over 100 different bourbons that you can try. And then we just had the list of bars. And this list was acquired by walking up and down the streets of the French Quarter. And then we began to discuss and argue for and against. And so we pared it down to something that was manageable to begin.
So you actually cover about 100 bars. I want to know what the hardest part in doing this really tough research was.
Well, I think the hardest part that in the end turned out to be a gift, really, was for me personally, I really thought that I would dislike covering the Bourbon Street bars. I thought, like a lot of locals, you know, this is a street, you just hold your breath, you put on your game face, you just quickly dart across the street and you get on to your other destination. But one of the surprises in the end was that even though we kept a lot of those Bourbon Street bars to the end of our research, is just how much I ended up really enjoying Bourbon Street and seeing its purpose, its place, its need in the city. And also along the way, the little places that you can go on Bourbon, like Johnny White's or Fretzel's or the old Absinthe House, where they feel different from the rest of the streets. Kind of step in and get a little refuge, but still be able to, in this very voyeuristic way, look out onto Bourbon Street and see all the action.
For each bar that you cover, there are a list of questions that you answer right off the bat, and that includes what your bar tab will be, what you're wearing, what you're hearing. Now, I have to say, I kind of stopped with tattoo themes. Why did we put tattoo themes in this book, y'all?
I will take the credit or blame for that. When I was much younger, I thought briefly that I would have a career as a cultural anthropologist. And I got kind of obsessed for a while with tattoos and sort of figuring out which cliques, which groups of people had which sorts of tattoos. For example, the sorts of tattoos that maybe motorcycle riders get are different than the sorts that sorority girls get, you know, on a weekend in New Orleans. So to me, the tattoos are really an extension of the dress code, because to me, they tell you as much about the people as anything. They're indicative of particular trends, what people are into, and also age. God bless them, the people with the Elton John tattoos or the Ziggy tattoos are, you know, from one era. The people with the Betty Page tattoos are from another era. So to me, they're very telling. Maybe they'll be telling to some readers. If not, gloss over them and no harm done.
I also think that the presence or absence of tattoos, or whether they're covered, is something that's noted. And I evacuated to Oxford, Mississippi for Katrina, and something that I was very aware of within days of drinking there, though I do not have a tattoo, I was very aware while out drinking that I never saw any. And I realized that I was not in New Orleans anymore.
This is the trick question. You know, I love to end with a trick question. Let's pretend an awful, terrible thing. What if it is last call for y'all in New Orleans? What is your favorite bar? What is the bar that you would choose to end your time here with?
I know. I absolutely know. Because I've thought about this a lot, the way that people think about their last meal.
Yes.
My last drink would be made by Chris Hanna at French 75, and it would be an old-fashioned. The old-fashioned is my mother's favorite drink, Carolyn Talley Pierce, who is a model in teaching me how to drink. And it is the drink that I grew up sipping. My entire drinking and non-drinking life is flavored with the elements of bourbon, bitters, and sugar. And French 75 is intimate and beautiful, and I can't think of a better way to leave.
Richard, how about you?
I wish I were that classy. But my last drink would probably be a domestic beer, light, if you please, at the Golden Lantern, ideally on Christmas Eve. There is a Christmas Eve drag show that happens at the Golden Lantern that is, I don't know if you've ever seen the John Waters movie Pink Flamingos, but there's this party scene that takes place at the trailer that is just a complete bacchanal. That is the only way to describe it, and that is the polite, like, family-friendly way of describing it. That's all I need. I need one good, very cold beer surrounded by a glorious freak show. You're not going to find that anywhere else.
And what about you, Allison?
This is a really tough question because I want to go both in the direction of Richard and in the direction of Elizabeth. So I'm going to say it's a tie between the Sazerac at the Sazerac Bar in the Roosevelt Hotel, which, by the way, is the only bar that is not actually in the French Quarter, but that we had to make an exception for. And it gets my vote because of the tremendous service that you get in that bar. For $10, sitting down in one of those seats and water carafes brought to you, little Chex Mix brought to you, and it's windowless. So if the end of the world was coming, you wouldn't see it. You could pretend. That or sucking down shooters at Crazy Corner, absolutely day glow, alcohol, party till dawn until you just all die. One of those two.
Now that we've heard what compelled the authors of the French Quarter Drinking Companion to write their book, when we come back, we'll hit the streets for cocktails in some very unlikely locations. Don't go anywhere.
When you hear us say, listener-supported public radio, what are we really saying? Public radio is shorthand for thought-provoking, well-crafted, stimulating programs. Listener-supported means it's your money that pays for those programs. And not only the programs, but the transmitters, the computers, the electricity, everything it takes to bring you those programs. So here's a very large thank you to you, the listener in listener-supported public radio. If you haven't yet offered your support, please contribute right now at krvs.org.
Join me, Megan Brown, for Encore for an exploration through the Cajun and Creole archives. We'll sample collections from folklore such as Alan Lomax, Elizabeth Brandon, Ralph Rinsler, and Barry Ocellet, just to name a few. I hope you'll tune in Saturdays at 7 a.m. and Sundays at 3 p.m. here on KRVS 88.7 Radio Acadie.
I'm Poppy Tooker, and you're listening to Louisiana Eats, edible content for Louisiana food lovers. Louisiana Eats is made possible with major support from Rouse's Markets. If you're just joining us, we've been speaking with Richard Reed, Elizabeth Pierce, and Allison Alsop, authors of The French Quarter Drinking Companion. After hearing about the motivation behind the book, we set off to tour some of the more obscure bars in the Quarter. Our first stop, Vacherie, a hotel bar at the corner of Toulouse and Dauphine. The bar was crowded, so once we got our drinks, we huddled together under the outdoor awning, avoiding a sudden rain shower. Not a bad way to spend the afternoon, as Allison pointed out.
We all know that drinking is an established tradition in the French Quarter, but sometimes we don't really stop to question why it is that it works so awfully well here. And one of the reasons is that it is just so simply easy. Unlike other places where you have to go and park and struggle and then take your car from bar to bar, here we just park, if you have had a car at all, and either on foot or rickshaw or carriage, make your way through the Quarter. And so part of the experience that we tried to capture in the book was not only just the experience of sitting in the bar, but of the actual ambulatory nature of meandering through the Quarter, and that part of the entertainment is actually what's happening between the bars as well.
Richard, in the book, one of the points that you all make is that drinking is fundamental to the identity of New Orleans. Explain that.
I don't know that I can explain it too well, except to say that I would compare it to, say, the fascination that we have with festivals here. And what is so interesting to me about festivals is that festivals are sort of low commitment. You go to Jazz Fest, You have something at this booth. You have something at that booth. You hear a little music at this stage, a little music at that stage, and then you move on. And the way that we drink in the quarter is very much the same. You go into a place, you don't particularly like the crowd, but they serve you a good drink. You can put it in a go cup and you can walk on to the next one. There's a very low threshold of commitment. It's not like you're stuck in one place. I won't name places in the United States where you're stuck there all night, but we all know what we're talking about, where you can't step outside with a drink. It's not like that at all here. It's just it's a relaxing way to go about an evening.
Elizabeth, we're standing just outside of Vacherie, where there is a bar that I know you're particularly fond of. Why is that?
Well, I have become fond of Vacherie, and partially because of one of the bartenders who works here. Her name is Victoria, and she used to serve me liberally and often at Le Chat Noir, which was a cabaret that closed a few years ago, and she moved over here. If you walk into Vacherie, you wouldn't include it maybe with some of the iconic locations that a lot of people think about when they think about drinking in the French Quarter, like Lafitte's Blacksmith Shop or Pat O'Brien's. But I think Vacherie embodies a particular kind of drinking that's really important in the French Quarter, and that is the hotel bar, where Victoria has shared with me she has acquired a different kind of regular. It's the regular who is staying in the hotel, who over a period of 3 or 5 days comes and drinks in her bar once, or I have seen several times. I have come in at the beginning of a tour, and there were some folks who were finishing to go out and go get dinner. And when I returned, they were coming back to finish their night there. And so she gets to know people, even if it's over just, you know, a small period. But the other thing that she pointed out, and this is the other thing tourists forget, is that the French Quarter is a neighborhood. People live here, people work here, and on any given evening, if you walk into the bar at Vacherie, the bar is full of locals who live within, you know, a 2-block stumbling radius. They are not unlike the hotel guests who stop in on their way out or on their way back. So it isn't the neighborhood bar that we would normally imagine in most areas of New Orleans, but the hotel bar serves its local clientele as much as it might serve a tourist.
So where are we going to go next, guys?
Well, I would suggest, since we're on Dauphine Street already, that we go for something that's a little more... a little more upbeat, maybe, than where we are right now at Vacherie, which is a very calm, sedate, sort of relaxing bar. We'll go to Good Friends, which is a nice halfway point. It's a great place for a relaxing drink, but if you want something a little more peppy, you can get that there, too.
Okay, let's go. We walked a few blocks down Dauphine Street while the rain continued to fall. By the time we arrived at Good Friends, several regulars had already taken up residence at the bar. I asked Richard what makes this bar stand out among others in the French Quarter.
Well, Good Friends is obvious, is on what we in New Orleans, what the LGBT community calls the Fruit Loop, which is actually more of an L than a technical loop. And every bar on the loop is a little different. So you have Lafitte's in Exile, you have the Pub in Oz, you have Good Friends, and you have Rawhide. And what I love about Good Friends is that while the music here is certainly energetic and it's a fun place to meet friends and hang out, it can be a very relaxing place. It's a great place to come at the end of the night if you're looking for a nightcap, or if you're just sort of starting out the evening and you want to ease into it. You can have a very civilized drink. They have a great selection of liqueurs, cognacs, that sort of stuff. There's a little bar upstairs that's totally charming and friendly. If you're here when the weather is great, there's a balcony. Great people watching, especially during some of the festivals like Southern Decadence and obviously during Carnival. It's right in the middle of all that. But it's also like a little oasis. It's kind of calm and quiet. It's not... the music never gets too loud. You can always have a great conversation. And that, to me, what is the hallmark of a great bar, is a place where you can have a really good conversation.
You know, I was particularly fascinated when I read the French Quarter Drinking Companion to read that term, the Fruit Loop, because I had never heard that before. And I even paused and I said to myself, is that even politically correct?
I would just say that that's one of those words we have to own. That is, honestly, it's been called that since I was a kid. And kind of disparagingly, but always with a warmth. It's just one of those places that when you have guests in town, you want to take them to the Fruit Loop because it's a great array of bars. And not only that, but you can walk from one to the other. It's a little sampler platter of everything that the community has to offer. Not absolutely everything. There are some others that lie off the beaten path a little more, like La Roundup and the Corner Pocket. But this gives you a pretty good lay of the land. Also, there's always something happening down here. There's always some sort of contest or drag show or something like that to keep you entertained and occupied that you're not going to see in wherever it is that you're from that is not New Orleans.
I think that something that crosses a lot of visitors' minds when we're talking about something like the LGBT scene in New Orleans and bars like this, you know, I think often there's a question, well, is it okay to go if you're straight? Would you address that?
Well, I would say that Richard has been a lovely ambassador to introducing us to some of these bars. And Good Friends was definitely a favorite of mine. I can walk in here. I can feel welcome. There is absolutely no pressure to be anything that I am not. So I don't think anyone should feel as though they are not entitled or welcome to come into any bar whatsoever. It is part of the experience of New Orleans, and it should be experienced no matter what your sexuality is, regardless.
I would also add that to me, that whole mixture, that mélange, is really what makes drinking in the Quarter so interesting to me. You go to other cities and you go drinking, and it doesn't matter if you're a straight bar, a gay bar, or someplace in between. Each bar has its own type. You know, you go to one bar and it's a little preppy, and another is a little more rock and roll. And so many bars here in the French Quarter, like you walk into the Abbey, is my favorite example. The Abbey, and you're standing there, and it's, you know, people who have just gotten off a shift. It's like 2 o'clock in the morning, and they've just worked for 8 hours in a very, very hot restaurant kitchen, and they're standing next to some goth kids from out in the suburbs who are standing next to a wedding couple who just got hitched and are just sort of stumbled out of their own wedding reception, next to some, you know, debutante who just wandered down the street from Maximo's. Who knows who you're going to be rubbing shoulders with? And I think the LGBT bars are a great example of that in action. It's open to anybody.
So, Elizabeth, where are we going to go next?
Well, it's not a trip to the Quarter unless you go to Bourbon Street. So we're going to head down to Johnny White's Hole in the Wall, number 2.
The weather cleared up significantly as we traipsed towards Bourbon Street. Dodging empty beer cans and puddles of rain under a sea of flashing neon lights, we ducked into a small bar in the 7th block of New Orleans' most notorious street. I am most surprised to learn of the existence of Johnny White's 2. Like, I knew about Johnny White's, which is over across from Pat O'Brien's and very famous for a lot of reasons, but what's this place about, and why did you want to come here?
Well, you're not alone in not knowing this bar. In fact, I think very few New Orleanians know about this bar. But I wanted to come down here for a few reasons. Number one, I wanted to make sure that we were on Bourbon Street at some point. But in our book, we're constantly noting the things that others might pass by or that even locals might know about, and I felt like this bar was definitely one of them. We're on Bourbon. All of the mayhem of Bourbon is happening just outside of these doors, and yet you can just step through this little set of French doors and enter into this very narrow bar, which takes us back to the history of New Orleans when Bourbon Street was not the mayhem that it is now, but was this premier residential street. And Johnny White's, if you look closely, you can still see in the architecture here the signs that we were in someone's salon, their parlor, their living room, and that this house used to just step out and onto this residential street. We've got a mantle in front of us. We still have some of the woodwork on the walls. And if you look towards the front of the bar, you can see the beam that probably let out onto the porch. So this is one place that I think, just when you think that you have figured out the quarter or figured out bourbon, it throws you a little surprise, and it always offers something if you look just a little bit closer.
So Johnny White's itself, you know, has this legendary presence, right, as, you know, the bar that never closed or whatever. But what I really responded to was the bartender's delight in how it shifts through the day from one kind of clientele to the other, like a sundial sort of moving around in this circle. The clientele of Johnny White's changes and can't be pinned down to only one description.
Yeah, just something I wanted to kind of follow up on that is, in the times that I have been in the hole in the wall here and also in Johnny White's number one, I think both of the Johnny White's bars has that feel. You can come in, you don't need to know anyone, you can easily strike up a conversation with the bartender or who's sitting next to you. It might be over the game or what's playing on the jukebox, but this is an easy bar to come into and made to be feel welcome. And there are some bars in this world where you feel like you have to show up with someone else, and there's other bars in this world where you can come in alone. And this is a bar that you can come in alone and have no issue with it whatsoever.
That's A Day in the Vieux Carré with the authors of The French Quarter Drinking Companion. Available online or in bookstores now. That's it for this week's edition of Louisiana Eats, edible content for Louisiana food lovers. Join us next week when we talk live fire cooking with Chef Ryan Pruitt.
They're pulling the coals that fall through a grate they have the fire burning in, and then cooking over them in either low heat or a high heat situation, or burying pots in it. And it was just this sort of entire kitchen where the cooking method was based on this giant amount of fire.
Subscribe to our podcast, hear today's show, or catch up on previous editions anytime online at wwno.org and louisianaeatsradio.com. Louisiana Eats is made possible with major support from Popeye's Louisiana Kitchen, Rouse's Markets, and Zatarain's. Additional support provided by Dickie Brennan and Company and Linda Green, the Yakima Ladies Soul Food Catering. Our media sponsor is Louisiana Life Magazine, the magazine of a great state. Original theme music by Johnny Sketch and the Dirty Notes. Thanks to executive producer Thomas Walsh and sound engineer Joe Schreiner. I'm Poppy Tooker. We'll see you next time. Louisiana Eats is a production of WWNO and the University of New Orleans.
Hi, this is Edward Watson from Lafayette, Louisiana. KRVS is my favorite radio station because there are no other radio stations to the right. Pete and Cecil, need I say more? My dog Stella is all about the KRVS too. Please join me in supporting KRVS during their annual spring fundraiser.
This is KRVS, 88.7 FM, Lafayette, Lake.